Welcome to the Josh Bolton Show, where we dive into interesting and inspiring conversations. And now, your host, Josh Bolton.
So tell me about yourself. I was trying to read your profile and it was so long. I'm like, what the description of you? I'm like, well, okay, what are we going over?
Yeah, one of these days I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up, you know? It's kind of one of those things. I don't know where you want to start. I played college basketball. Okay. Was lucky enough to play against Michael Jordan when I was in college.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, along with a bunch of other people. Kind of a funny story. My brother actually coached Michael Jordan's two sons in high school. And nice. He always tells the story. He said, one day I'm at practice and I'm teaching the kids to play. And he said, I look up, nobody's paying any attention to me at all. And he said, I look over to where they're looking. He said, they're all looking at the door. Jordan had come into the gym as a parent. It was towards the end of practice just to pick up his kids
right.
and take them home. So my brother says to him, hey, Michael, you're a little bit of a distraction. Would you mind stepping out in the hall until practice is over? Jordan was a great guy. He said, yeah, sure, coach, no problem. I'm sorry about that. And my brother thought later, he said, you know, I'm probably the only coach in the history of basketball that's ever kicked Michael Jordan out of practice, you know.
And that's so, probably he was just like, all right, hey, you had the balls to say it.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm out. You know, see you later. So anyway, played college basketball. You know, I had numerous jobs. Was in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International in their marketing department. Mm-hmm. Was the hospital administrator. Was a police officer. Did undercover narcotic work. I was a SWAT team hostage negotiator. Had my own school security consulting business. Been a motivational speaker, girls basketball coach. Last year, I became an author. But for the last 9 years or so, I've been what I consider myself as a cancer warrior, as I've been fighting this rare form of melanoma that's okay. Seen me lose my foot. And then last year, I had my leg amputated.
Oh, no. So
kind of dealing with all that. And that's pretty much me.
That's awesome. Actually, I'm just going to keep all that. That's too good. So Terry Tucker, right?
Correct.
So Terry, tell us tell us about how you went from your basketball career to marketing, like your basketball and everything you've done, and then the marketing.
Yeah. So I was like everybody else, you know, I had this college degree. I had this business administration degree. And now what do you do with that? You know, I was all set to make my mark on the world with, you know, this newly obtained business administration degree. And I sort of chuckle when I look back on it and realize, you know, what a knucklehead I was to think I knew anything about business just because I had a piece of paper that said I did. So, you know, I was actually the first person in my family to graduate from college. And I'm really going to date. Pardon me?
So congrats.
Thank you. I'm really going to date myself now, but this was long before the internet was available. So my family was living in Ohio at the time, and I moved back home to find a job. And Wendy's is in a suburb of Columbus, the capital of Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I applied and went through the interview process and was lucky enough to kind of get in on the heyday of fast food when we were, you know, involved in all kinds of stuff, breakfast and hot dogs and all kinds of things like that. So that was really my transition from wanting to, you know, to be a basketball player, which I was, but I had three knee surgeries in high school and I had one in college. So I wasn't going any farther than
college.
You know, I was lucky to play in college. So I was just fortunate to find that first job out of college.
So then I'm curious, when you say you dated yourself, is it 1970s back or is it 1980s?
So I graduated from college in 1982. So it was early 1980s.
Okay. Okay. Because the internet was around back in like the 70s-ish, but it was like you had to like know everything. I think it was the 80s when they introduced the personal computers, when everyone could. You still had to know coding, but you still could get on.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being in college and taking, you know, a computer class, and it was literally, you know, you filled out all this coding, and, you know, if you missed a period or a comma or a slash or something like that, the whole thing was wrong, you know, and then would take it to a special room and they would put it on cards And then the card, you take the cards over and they'd run it through the computer. And, you know, if it worked, you got your program. If it didn't, it's like, you didn't know what was wrong. You know, where did you miss that period? Or, you know, where did you miss that exclamation point or whatever it was? So, yeah, right. it was much different back then than it is today.
It is. I mean, like compared to here where I just click a button and boom, you're here. Back then you had like had to know coding and it was the how times have changed.
Yes, they have. Thankfully for the better.
Yes. So what were some of the biggest marketing campaigns you helped Wendy's out that maybe that one of those, if we just look back and be like, oh, that's what Terry did? What kind of thing?
Yeah. So I started out in field marketing, which the Wendy's was an international company. So they had marketing people all over the world. Mm-hmm. And then the United States was divided into different regions and stuff like that. And after I did that for about a year and a half, and then I switched over to new product marketing, which was actually a lot of fun because, you know, we were testing all kinds of different things. One of the things that I was involved in that never really got off the ground was hot dogs. Wendy's was going to sell hot dogs. And the thing you've got to remember is that whenever you introduce a new item into the stores, you're going to cannibalize another item. So if we introduce hot dogs, we might not sell as many singles or doubles or triples or chicken sandwiches or whatever it is. So there's always a trade-off. And the trade-off is this going to make us enough money to offset what we're going to lose in whatever it's going to cannibalize? So we ended up putting hot dogs into about half the company stores in the United States. And part of what I used to get to do was I would travel all over the country, unbeknownst to the stores. And I would just, you know, say I went to Indianapolis and I would just go to as many stores in Indianapolis as I could. And I would make sure, you know, was it displayed properly on the menu? Were the point of purchase, you know, photographs correct? Was it suggestively sold when I got up to the cash register and stuff like that? And sometimes I'd even basically buy the product, stick it in a bag. And then, you know, when it was time to leave, I'd take it back. And, you know, it was like, was it presented properly? Was, you know, so it was pretty, excuse me, it was pretty interesting to kind of do that. And so hot dogs was a big thing. We spent a lot of money testing hot dogs to the point where we decided not to sell hot dogs because it was going to cannibalize too much of our hamburger business.
That's so weird. I would never pick Wendy's for a hot dog place.
I know.
I know. Mean, like a chicken burger, especially with the current times, it makes sense. I mean, actually, if you don't sell it, it's kind of stupid. But yeah, I would not peg Wendy's for a hot dog place.
I know. And I mean, the hot dogs were good. They really were. And I'm not a big hot dog person, but, you know, it's kind of a funny story. There was a piece of equipment that, you know, and you've probably seen it in different restaurants where, you know, the hot dog is on it and it kind of rolls it back and forth. It sort of keeps the hot dog warm. And that piece of equipment was called a 3WR. And that stood for Wendy's Wonderful Wiener Roller. But, you know, the official name of it was 3WR. So it was, you know, somebody had a great sense of humor when they named that.
Oh, yeah, they did. Wonderful Wiener Roller. So then what was some other projects you worked on before you you left and moved on to, you said, police?
I did.
Okay.
I mean, one of the other big menu items that I worked on was breakfast. Wendy's had, you know, McDonald's had breakfast. It had it for a while. And it was a day part that we did not have. I mean, we were not open, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning for coffee and, you know, an egg McMuffin and things like that. So we were kind of trying to position ourselves more as an upscale breakfast type of place, you know, where you could get the, you know, the nice hotcakes or the scrambled eggs and sausage and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was a day part that actually took off. It was something that we did for a while. And then it was well after I left that they kind of closed it down and kind of went back to the basics. You know, you only have so much space in a restaurant. And right. Only so much space in the back room and only so much space to store product and things like that. So you know, you have to get creative with, you know, if you put in a day part like breakfast, I mean, that's not just putting in a hot dog, you know, that's putting in an entire day part. So you've got to have orange mm-hmm. juice, you got to have Danish, you got to have all these kind of things. So you have to be able to store it. You have to be able to prep it. You know, you have to train the staff on it. It's a huge undertaking. And eventually, you know, the whole fast food industry kind of came to a, I'm not going to say a grinding halt, but people were like, you know, this stuff is no good for you. And it's like, well, it's not necessarily no, I mean, if you ate it every day, yes, it would not be good for you, but occasionally it's fine. So a lot of the fast food, McDonald's and everything kind of pulled back and said, wait a minute, we're going to go back to the basics. And Wendy's did that too. And they got rid of breakfast. And now I've seen, you know, commercials where they're offering breakfast again. So, you know, go figure. It's just kind of, I'll never forget. We had cases and cases and cases of a product called Crest, and Crest stood for Consumer Reports on Eating Share Trends. And I could tell you who ate what, when, where, why, how, with who, at what time for almost any food that was out there. So you could use, we subscribe to this data, and we knew that, okay, yeah, we want to get into the breakfast business because it, you know, X number of people are eating breakfast every morning outside the home. And, you know, here's the demographic of those people. And you know, here's where they live and here's what kind of cars. I mean, it was, the data was amazing. And that's kind of how we made our decisions, whether we decided to test a product or not.
So that was back in the 80s. You had all that data too?
Yeah.
That's insane.
It was all in volume. It was all in notebooks and things like that. It wasn't online, but yeah, we had that data.
So you had more of an edge even back in the 80s when before you had the internet and you could easily just type into Google trends and be like, so what does this mean? And be like, oh, it's trending down. Let's not do that instead.
Right. Right. Thing.
That's crazy. So, okay. Business mind for me. How did you determine the breakfast sandwich was a go for certain regions? Was it because of their job, their food, their car, this or that? Like, how did you target that?
So what we did is we started out in, and we would take a company market. Let's say, again, let's go back to Indianapolis. That was a company market as opposed to a franchise market, you know, that where a franchisee owned it. So in a company market, we could pretty much do whatever we want because the company owned those stores. And so we would, you know, I mean, it really started, we had a kitchen in the corporate headquarters and we had these booths and people would, you know, the staff at the, excuse me, at the restaurant or at the, in the kitchen would go around and be like, hey, do you want to do a taste test today? And I mean, we taste tested stuff all the time. So let's say, you know, we're going to taste test a breakfast sandwich. Well, you know, you don't know what you're taste testing. Maybe it's the sausage, maybe it's the cheese, maybe it's the bun, maybe, you know, whatever it is, you know, the egg product, where are we going to get the egg? So we would test all this stuff and then synthesize that down to say, okay, this is the product that we're going to offer. Now you've got to get a supplier for that product and you've got to get, you know, somebody to train the staff on how to prepare the product and how to package the product and where's the packaging going to be and what's the packaging going to look like and how are we going to design that? And, you know, I mean, I was literally in New York several times sitting on a set where when we were doing hot dogs, where we were just photographing hot dogs. I mean, after, you know, initially it was cool. After a while, it was like, oh my God, seriously? You know, I mean, we were like this. I mean, literally we would wad up napkins, put them in the bottom of the bun to get the hot dog to sit up higher in the bun so that you could see it. And then literally somebody would painstakingly put every drop of mustard, ketchup, relish, onions, every one of those was placed individually. So it took hours to get a hot dog ready just to take one photograph that you were then going to put up in the restaurant to advertise that product. So it was just a huge undertaking. I mean, it wasn't something that you could like, okay, we're going to do hot dogs in the stores tomorrow. It took months to plan all that, to get everything logistically in place. And then it was like, this isn't going to work. You know, this, we can't do this. We got to do this another way and stuff like that. So it was a tremendous learning curve and trying to kind of nuance your way through that. But it was also a lot of fun.
I would say also back then, it sounded like that was the old film cameras too. You didn't, there was no such thing as digital really until like 2000s.
I mean, it was like literally you're shooting a hot dog. It was like shooting a supermodel. Yeah. I mean, that's how much time went into. I mean, they would coat the top of the bun with a type of, I don't even know what it was. It was a type like a vegetable oil that made the bun shine. I mean, like I say, it was it was just amazing watching them do that. And then your responsibility was to come over and say, yeah, that looks good. Go ahead and shoot it. I mean, so you'd sit around for hours while they got this hot dog ready to shoot. And then as the marketing representative, it was, or you know, no, that's not, that doesn't look right. Or, you know, we can't do it that way because it misrepresents how the product will be sold and that. So you had to be a little bit more than, yeah, that looks fine. Shoot it. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, because I'm saying, especially with film was exceedingly expensive back in the 80s. So you pretty much had one, maybe two tries, and that's all you got.
Well, yeah, you would think. But I mean, Wendy's was at the time a Fortune 50 company. So we spent a ton of money on, I mean, we had a national, you know, advertising agency in New York. I mean, we had local and regional advertising agencies that were responsible for the local promotions and things like that. So it was it was a lot of money spent on, you know, and again, in new product marketing, you're just guessing that this is going to work. You know, I mean, you don't know. Like I said, we went through this whole thing with hot dogs and decided not to do it. So you're right. Spending a lot of money hoping that you're going to recoup those costs when you actually go live with the product in the stores.
So, okay. Other than hot dogs, what else did you help out with for the marketing and product photography?
The other thing I did that I was involved with was the breakfast day part.
Okay.
So pretty much hot dogs and breakfast were the two things that I was involved with.
Okay. So then what inspired you to go from marketing and taking pictures of hot dogs and buns to a police officer? Was it the pay, job security, or just wanted a new adventure?
It was not the pay, I can tell you that much. It was my passion, in all honesty. It was my purpose. It was something that I felt I wanted to do. My grandfather was a Chicago police officer from 1924 to 1954. So he was in Chicago during Prohibition, when alcohol was outlawed in the United States. He was in Chicago during the Great Depression in the 30s. He was in Chicago during, you know, the gangs, you know, Al Capone and all those guys. So he was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. Wasn't a serious injury. He was shot in the ankle, taking a murder suspect back to the lockup. But my father always remembered the stories that my grandmother told of the knock on the door of, you know, Mrs. Tucker, grab your son, come with us. Your husband's been shot. And when I said I wanted to go into law enforcement, my dad was like, absolutely not. You're going to go to college. You're going to major in business. You're going to get a job when you get out. You're going to get married, have 2.4 kids and live in the suburbs. I mean, my dad had my entire life planned out, but that was the life that he wanted me to lead, not the life that I wanted to lead. And when I got out of college, I ended up living with my parents for the next 3.5 years when I got out, because my father and my grandmother, who was living with us as well, were both dying of different forms of cancer. So I had to help my mother. So my dad, I knew, didn't want me to be in law enforcement. Excuse me. But I also knew that that was my passion. And so I kind of joke. I said, I did what every good son did. I waited until my father passed away, and then I pursued my dreams. So if you look at my, you know, my first two jobs, Wendy's and marketing, and then I was a hospital administrator for a while, I waited till my dad died, and then I pursued my dreams. And by all accounts, I was a 37-year-old rookie cop, which is pretty old to be starting that job.
Yeah, I think even my age at 28, it's a little too old to try for most standards.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's, you know, if you're going to run a beat and chase bad guys down and stuff like that, you know, that's not something you want to start when you're in your late 30s. So, but you know, I was lucky. I'd been an athlete my whole life. So it was a little bit easier for me.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a little bit of an edge compared to the others. So being a cop, there had to have been crazy stories that happened with that.
Yeah, there were, I mean, there were all kinds of, you know, goofy stories of, you know, I could probably tell you a bunch of, you know, gone for hours, but I'll give you a couple when I was a hostage negotiator, because those are kind of the most interesting in a way. Give you two, but both are kind of funny. One's a little more tragic than the other one. So we were not a full-time SWAT team. And again, I'm going to date myself. We carried pagers back then. And so when the pager went off, you know, you called in and gave them your number, and then they told you where to go, where the situation was.
Right.
So I happened to be working that night. The pager went off. So I got to the scene pretty quickly because I was in a marked car. And I get there and I'm talking to the district guys and I'm like, what's the deal? It's like, he's drunk. He's barricaded himself in the house with his wife and a gun. I'm like, okay. It's like, but we have him on the phone. So I'm like, all right. So I get the phone and I talk to him for about 10 minutes. And it was not a typical call. You know, it was usually have to build up trust and rapport. This guy was just drunk. So I just kind of went out on a limb and I'm like, what would it take for you to come out? He's like, give me a beer. I said, if I got you a beer, I'd have your word that you let your wife go, you put the gun down and you'd come out. He's like, do I have your word that I could drink the beer? I said, sure. I said, so I gave $5 to one of the district guys. I said, go down to the store, get a beer. Came back, put it on the front porch, called them and said, hey, your beer's on the front porch, but you don't get it unless your wife comes out, you put the gun down and then you come out. And he was like, do I have your word I can drink the beer? I'm like, you absolutely have my word. And here comes his wife. Here he comes with his hands up. We handcuff him, let him drink the beer. Off to jail he goes. So, you know,
you did follow your word.
I did. You know, that was one thing about being a negotiator. Excuse me. We never lied to anybody because we had people that were like, I'll come out, but I don't want to go to jail. It's like, well,
that doesn't work.
Yeah. When you come out, you're going to go to jail. But then we would try to deflect it into something, you know, a little bit more reasonable that we could talk about. And so the next one is, like I said, a little more tragic. So this guy wanted to kill himself and he had slit his wrists and that didn't work. And then he put his head in the oven and turned on the gas. And I didn't quite get that one, but
I kind of get it.
Pardon me?
I said, I kind of get that one, but it would have taken a lot more than just an oven though.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that didn't work. Well, then he called a family member and a family member was smart enough to call the police. And we get there and I'm talking to him. He's got a gun now. He's going to shoot himself. Okay. So we talked for about 3 hours. And finally, in all honesty, I think I just warmed down. I think he was tired. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I want to come out. I'm like, okay, good. I said, you know, put the gun down, come out. And I said, when you come out, I said, I'll come down to the scene with you and we'll talk face to face. He's like, okay, I'd like that. Excuse me. So he says, all right. I said, but don't hang the phone up. Just bring the phone with you. But he ends up hanging the phone up. About 2 minutes later, one of the tactical team comes on the radio and is like, we heard a gunshot. And I thought, you didn't. He did. Shot himself in the head. Shot himself in the left temple. The bullet went underneath his skin, around the outside of his skull, and came out the other side. Never penetrated his skull, never got to his brain. So what? This is three times he tried to kill himself. I mean, obviously it was bloody, you know, bloody scene. I mean, a head wound, it's going to bleed a lot. But in terms of being a severe injury, really wasn't, you know. So we put him in the ambulance. He went to the hospital and eventually went to jail. And, you know, I think that's God's way of saying, look, hey, you tried three times. I don't want you here yet. It's not your time. Don't do that.
I would say that sounds like complete divine intervention. Yeah. You don't have to believe in a God or anything. That right there, the way it curved, I'm like, that's someone manipulated it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just like, really, you shot yourself in the head, but like, you know, just wasn't your day to die.
The big man's like, nope, not today, my friend. Mm-mm.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So I have a few cop buddies, and then me and them have talked about different stuff. Like, at one point in my life, I was thinking of working the prisons because they would get a lot of money, a lot of OT. I could save up and invest later. And the cop buddy that was going to get me in, he's like, I would get you in. I'm good with the warden. He'd hire you and all that. But he's like, you're too good for this. You're too nice. This would change you. He's like, people say the prison's scum of the earth. He's like, the prisoners themselves are not bad, actually. They realize they messed up. He's like, it's actually your coworkers you have to be careful about. And I'm like, what? He's like, they're really just criminals with badges. I'm like, but you're one. He's like, I do my job, though. I'm like, that's the only difference. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'm not going to be a cop then. But that's where he told me all like the different, because he used to be in the field, but he wanted a more routine instead of working like randomly 19 hours. He just wanted his 10, 12 hours. That's it. So that's where he went to the prisons. But he told me, he's like, there was one time, he's like, there was a criminal running down the 210 freeway, high on something. And he's like, everyone was telling us to shoot him. But he's like, I just took my taser, hit him. He fell because he stiffened up face first, blew out all his teeth. And then because he's like, because it's on a freeway, and the district guy called, and he's like, wait, he pulled everyone to the side, said, I'll buy you all one meal. Or if there's four of you, I'll buy you all a meal. I need a report saying I did my job and I didn't hurt him. And so he's like, that was about a $200 endeavor, but I saved my job.
Well, you know, a lot of that has to do with how you're trained, mm-hmm. you know, and for us, when we got tasers, when I first started, we did not have tasers. When we got tasers, it was literally in the hierarchy of use of force, it was your presence. That didn't work. It was verbal commands. And if that didn't work, we could tase them. You know, it wasn't like you had to stick them or, you know, mace them or anything like that. You could tase them. And Taser was a great product. I mean, it prevented a lot of injuries for officers. It also prevented a lot of injuries for suspects because, I mean, I don't care how big and strong you are. You know, somebody's drunk or high. I remember one night we stopped, my partner and I, when I was in uniform, we stopped the car. It was like 10 below zero. And this guy, he immediately jumps out and you're like, oh God, he's going to run. And he did. And he takes off running. And he ran through a construction site and he tried to get over this like 10-foot chain link fence. And you can't tell this from looking at me, but I'm 6'8". And at the time I was 240 pounds. So I was not somebody that usually got in a lot of fights. People were at least smart enough to like, yeah, I'm probably not going to win this. So I ended up literally, it was in the middle of winter. Obviously it was cold. And I grabbed him off the fence. And as I did, my feet slipped out from underneath me because they were on ice. And I literally pulled him right down on top of me. And he's wailing on me. I mean, you know, I'm covering up and stuff like that. Well, I had a partner, a female partner, who was a black belt in karate. She jumps on his back and hits him with a forearm in the back of the head. It would have knocked most people out. He picks her up like a rag doll and just throws her off. By that time, I get up. I mean, I've got him by, you know, his lapels. He's got me by lapels. I am kneeing him in the groin over and over and over. And it's having no effect whatsoever. And finally, I was just strong enough that I was able to flip him and get him on the ground and just lay on him until the rest of the troops came and we handcuffed him. But he was high as a kite and he was feeling no pain whatsoever. So, you know,
you think it was PCP?
It very well could have been. I mean, he also had a felony warrant. So he had a vested interest in getting away because he was going to go away for a while. And that, so, I mean, but it was like, I remember doing the use of force with the sergeant afterwards and like, so you need him in the groin? I'm like, multiple times. I said like 6, 8, 10 times. I'm just kneeing him. And it's having, and I'm hitting him. It's not like I'm missing. And it's having no effect on him whatsoever. I'm sure his testicles were pretty sore the next morning when all that wore off.
Oh, yeah. I'm just trying to think about it because I'm like, ooh, a normal person, unless they're on drugs, they would eventually, even drunk, you just fall over. You're just like, oh, I can't handle this. If he's not flinching, he had to be on something that heavy.
Yeah, pain compliance was not working. And I mean, at the time, we did not have tasers, you know, and I mean, literally, I'm starting, you know, I'm like, okay, we've hit him, we've punched him, we've kneed him, we've done, you know, I mean, we're getting to the point where we're running out of options. We're going to have to shoot him, you know, right, to stop him. And fortunately, I was, like I said, I just was able to get him on the ground and lay on top of him until, you know, we got four or five more cops there. We're able to take him into custody.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of those, like, I've heard stories about it, but I never was, or I was, but it was one of those too young to even know about it, was I heard about the rampant PCP in the late 80s, early 90s. And I was just like, is it like when you hear about it in school, you're like, oh, I mean, because we didn't have any reference. Like, it doesn't sound that bad. Is it that bad? Kind of thing. And I've, as I've talked to different officers like you, they're like, the one I was getting me into prison, he told me about a case like that. And he's like, dude, I still to this day can't get over it. He's like, this big guy, just, he's obviously roided out, so he doesn't care about drugs. He's on PCP and something else. And he's like, we put 5 buckshots in his chest and nothing. And I'm like, whoa, wait, okay. Like, even a bear after like 3 is like, okay, I'm gonna go over in the corner and die peacefully, kind of thing. He's like, nothing. 5 shots. And I'm like, okay, it's a bad drug.
Yeah. I mean, drugs in general are just, I mean, the things I saw when I was in the drug unit, the things that people would do, you know, in terms of selling their bodies and things like that, just for a hit of crack was insane. Disgusting. I mean, the crack houses that I hit with search warrants, you know, that SWAT would go in and clear out and stuff like that were, I mean, I don't want to gross your audience out, but I mean, the things, like I said, that people did were, it was disgusting.
It's a whole separate topic.
Totally.
But you said you were also undercover for that too, right?
I did.
So, okay. How did you condition yourself to be the character to win their trust, kind of thing? Did you just not like shower for a month, dirty up your clothes?
See, I never did any of that. I never grew a beard. I let my hair grow. I never did anything like that. I kind of picked and choose what I did. Like one time, I was a policeman in Cincinnati, Ohio, and one of the day shift drug people called me and said, "Hey, I got these kids coming down from Dayton. They want to sell mushrooms. Will you buy them?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure." So I posed as a professor of metallurgy. I didn't know anything about metal, you know, but I posed as a professor of metallurgy. I met these kids in a park, you know, gave them the $200 for the mushrooms. You know, they gave me the mushrooms. They got in their car. And then instead of partying in downtown Cincinnati, they partied at the Hamilton County Justice Center because about 5 cars just all of a sudden swooped in on them and picked them up. So, I mean, you kind of have to act a little bit. A lot of what I did was use informants. So I'd sit on a house, you know, I'd kind of watch it for a while. Somebody'd go in for 2 seconds and, you know, and then come out and then drive away. Well, then I'd do a traffic stop on them, you know, for a traffic offense. They didn't stop at the stop sign. They didn't use a turn signal. And, you know, I was good at talking. So, hey, can I search your car? Yeah, sure. And then you'd find the drugs. And it's like, well, here's the deal. You're going to go to jail or you're going to work for me and I'm going to wire you up and send you back in there and you're going to buy for me. And if you do that, then I'd consider, you know, asking the prosecutor to dismiss your case. And so that's a lot of what I did. And then I, you know, I type up a search warrant and have the SWAT team, you know, hit the house and, you know, arrest the people that were in there. And then we tear the house apart looking for all the drugs and, you know, get a house out of, you know, a drug house, which were mostly in neighborhoods, put them out of business.
Interesting. Interesting. Because I would assume at least back then, you also had a bit of a more competitive edge in technology compared to the most civilians, like better telescopes or recorders kind of thing. Not really.
That was the other thing about when you bought dope yourself. I mean, you were wired up and I'm not going to give away, you know, the kind of things that we use, you know, to wire people up with. But a lot of times, you know, all of a sudden you'd be taught and it, the person would cut out. And, you know, safety for us was always important. I mean, I was shot at a couple times, you know, buying dope. I had friends that literally had guns put in their faces, you know, that I worked with and stuff like that. And it's like, I can't hear them. I don't know what's going on. And so we would be like, oh, the hell with it. And we would all just, you know, we'd saturate the area and find the person because it was about safety. It wasn't about locking anybody up at that time. And, right. You know, I'm sure because we did that and didn't wait, we probably saved a couple of cops' lives who, you know, they may have shot them and robbed them, because that was another big issue was, you know, people would rob you of your money. You know, they'd stick a gun in your face. Give me your money. Get out of here now and stuff, you know. And it's like, you know, if you're on a wire and you're like, whoa, wait, hey, put the gun away. I mean, as soon as somebody would say gun, it was like all bets were off and everybody was coming in. So it was like, yeah, you're probably not going to get away because there's, you know, 12, 14 of us that are strategically placed all around, you know, where we're doing the buy.
Right. Yeah, there's at least three within sight and then one maybe half a block away. So it's not obvious.
Right.
Like a couple others, like six or seven. Yeah, that's crazy. That's one of those, like I told a nerd guest, he's a Navy SEAL, and we chatted about his endeavors. I'm like, that's one of those, unless you're in the shit, you'll never figure it out. It's a great story to hear, but it's like, there's so many emotions that in the moment, like, you can't relate because it's just like, you processed and immediately got rid of it because it was too much.
Yeah, it's definitely something, you know, I didn't tell a lot of, you know, I would tell my family a little bit of the stories, but, you know, most of it we just kept for ourselves. And it's like, yeah, you know, today was a good night. And like I said, it was all about being safe. Didn't matter how much dope we bought. It didn't, you know, didn't matter who we put away and stuff like that. It was just about making sure everybody went home at the end of the night.
Right. Because you guys have families too. So it's like, right. We got to make sure everyone gets back as often as we can. Yeah. So you went from cop to motivational speaker, right? Or was it there a transition between that?
So After I left the police department, I became a school security consultant. And I worked with private independent schools around the United States to help them with their physical security, their policies and procedures and things like that. And I also coached, I was a girls high school basketball coach at the time. So, you know, it was kind of nice being your own boss. You could kind of ramp up, you know, the work when basketball season wasn't going on and then kind of back off of it, you know, when the season was going on. So I kind of did those two jobs simultaneously before I became a motivational speaker.
So how did the security thing, I'm taking this in the late 90s, early 2000s when you're doing this?
It was in the, I mean, not so much early, you know, 2005.
I can see that early.
2010, 2012, somewhere in there.
Okay. Yeah. So what was the big thing why you realized, partially probably with your police training, but you realized you need to help schools with their security?
Yeah. I mean, initially I had, our daughter went to a private independent Catholic school when we lived in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I was asked by the school to, would you come in and look at our physical security? Would you look at our policies and procedures and stuff like that? And I was like, well, yeah, sure. You know, my daughter goes to school here. I obviously want it to be as safe as possible, but that was kind of the light bulb that was like, oh, you know, maybe I can do this full time. And so the guy who ran the business side of the school, I asked him, I'm like, look, I'll do this for you and I'll do it for free. But if I want to start a business, will you introduce me to people? Because there's an association of private independent schools.
Right.
That, you know, I said, will you introduce me to some of your friends? And, you know, I'll make proposals and things like that. And that's kind of how I got the job going. I remember I worked with a Jewish school in Houston, you know, and I asked them, I'm like, well, why did you decide on me? And they're like, well, we had the Mossad. And I don't know if you know what the Mossad is. They're the Israeli kind of secret service. They're the sort of the undercover people. It's like they came in and assessed the school and they wanted to put barbed wire around the entire school and guys with Uzis on the roof. And we're like, we're not doing that. You know, that's just something we're not doing. So we want a more practical approach to being able to do this. And would you come in and assess the school and then do the policies and procedures and then teach the staff what they needed to do. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I can do that. And so one, you know, a lot of that was word of mouth. You do a good job for this school. And then, you know, somebody's at a meeting and they're talking about it. Oh, hey, I got somebody that could do it for you. So that's kind of how the business unfolded.
How long did you do that?
About 9 or 10 years.
Nice. Well, okay. Curious. What was your average rate for your average fee? Obviously it's variable per student, but per school, but it was like, what was your average? Like 10, 20,000?
I charged $125 an hour. And that was for going into the school, you know, assessing all the buildings, writing the report, you know, do you want me to write policies and procedures for you? Yes. Okay. Then it'll, you know, take me this much to do that. Do you want me to train your staff? Yes. Then it'll take. So it really depended on what the school wanted. It was sort of an a la carte kind of thing. You can have me just assess the school. You can have me write policies and procedures. You can have me train your staff. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do that. But it's $125 an hour.
Especially back then, that was a lot.
I mean, you know, yes, I wanted to make money, but I also wanted to help.
Right.
You know, to make a difference in these schools. But, you know, there's a point where if you're too cheap, people don't want to use you. You know, they don't think you're any good. So you kind of have to, you know, put the bar up there where it's $125 an hour. Well, you may not know what the heck you're doing at all, but because you have this rate, people think that you know what you're doing, so they'll use you. It's kind of funny, I thought.
It really is. Like, I have a mentor I talk to every Thursday. It's a group call. And there's one of the guys in the call is like, I want to be a consultant for like Fortune 500s. And he's like, great. Show us the product. We all did our 2 cents. And he's like, I'm only going to charge him 4,000. And I just immediately looked up. And before even the mentor spoke up, I'm like, I wouldn't hire you. And he's like, what? I'm like, 4,000? I feel like you're going to intentionally steal my data. I said, I need at least 100K to be convinced you're not going to screw me over. He's like, but that's way too much money. I'm like, well, it's also one client. You only need one client a year then. And he was just like, immediately we all just started ripping him because we're like, dude, product's good. This is good. But it's like your price. Yeah. We're not convinced. Like maybe small businesses, like if you're helping a mom and pop, but you don't want to run them bankrupt kind of thing. Yeah. 4,000 or 5,000, pretty much like pay for my month of rent and you're good to go kind of thing. But I'm like, yeah, Fortune 500, like, well, it's almost like a million standard issue. And he's like, well, I want to do security. And that's why I got interested. I'm like, what was your inspiration for that kind of thing?
For doing security?
Yeah.
I mean, it was really, you know, it started out as, well, my daughter's at this school. I want to make sure this school is as secure as as possible. I have, you know, training, background, experience, education that, you know, I've got an undergraduate degree. I've got a master's degree. I've been to law school. You know, I had the pedigree to be able to do it. But for me, it really wasn't about making a lot of money. It was really about helping these schools. And that was, you know, once I got sort of a taste of what this would be like, I'm like, you know, I can work out of my home. You know, I can make my own hours. I don't want to work during the morning. Well, you know what? I'll work till 10 o'clock at night, you know, after everybody goes to bed and things like that. So it was really kind of a nice, I want to make a difference, but this also works with my family dynamic in terms of being at my kids, you know, events at school and or being able to take them and pick them up from school and things like that. So it was really, I've got experience and training and background in this. And I can make a difference. And that's kind of how it started.
That's what was the listing like that. I have this degree. That's where I was like, okay, well, there's one more layer kind of thing. He just needed the school to nudge him. So then you went from the security consultant to motivational speaker. So, okay. That one is like, what was the inspiration?
So the motivational speaker kind of came after I was diagnosed with this rare form of cancer.
Okay.
And so I was a girls high school basketball coach and I had a callus that broke open on the bottom of my foot right below my third toe. And initially I didn't give it a lot of thought. I'm like, you know, I'm a coach, I'm on my feet a lot. But after a couple of weeks that it didn't heal, I went to see a podiatrist friend of mine, a foot doctor. And he took an x-ray and he's like, Terry, I think you have a cyst in here and I can cut it out. And he did. And he showed it to him. It was just a gelatin sac with some white fat in it. You know, no blood, no dark spots, nothing that would give anybody concern. And so he sent it off to pathology. And then 2 weeks later, I get a call from him. And as I said, he was a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he was having telling me, telling me what was going on, the more frightened I became. And so finally, he just laid it out. He said, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. I have never seen the form of cancer that you have. You have a rare form of melanoma, which we all think of kind of a skin disease. You know, you're out in the sun too much or something like that, that appears either on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands. There's only about 6,500 people in the U.S. that get this form of cancer every year. So it's a very rare form of melanoma. He said, I recommend you go to MD Anderson, which is probably one of the best cancer hospitals, certainly in the United States, if not the world, and be treated. And so I did, you know, and I had the tumor cut out of my foot, had all the lymph nodes removed in my groin. And then when I healed, I was put on a weekly injection of a drug called interferon. And I took these weekly injections for almost 5 years. And what interferon gave me was severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection. So imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And that was just to keep the disease from coming back. That was not a cure. And then when the disease did come back in 2017, I had to have my left foot amputated in January of 2018, came back again in 2019, two more surgeries. And then last year, an undiagnosed tumor in my ankle grew large enough that it fractured my tibia, my shin bone. And my only recourse right in the middle of the pandemic was to have my left leg amputated above the knee. And I also found out that I had tumors in my lungs. So I've had this odyssey, this journey, and I've turned that into motivational speaking, talking about my story, how I've gotten to this point, how I should have been dead several times, but, you know, kind of like the story we talked about earlier about the guy who shot himself in the head. You know what? Not my time to go yet. As long as, you know, and I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that. I figure, you know, when I go, that decision's way above my pay grade.
Sorry, I muted because there was dog barking.
That's okay.
So that's insane. Like I was picking up on your lungs earlier when you were coughing and you mentioned the cancer and I was like, oh, okay. Like I've heard of it spreading, but I'm like, but it's melanoma. I don't think it could get in the lungs. But then as you kept coughing, I'm like, oh, there's something in there kind of thing. And then you said it, but yeah, that's crazy how it like the tumor, like cyst thing, like pretty much broke your shin, right?
Yeah. I had, before the December, right before Christmas, a couple months before all this started, I had had an old procedure where they ran chemotherapy through my leg,
right,
for about an hour. And they don't do that anymore usually, but they tried this and I developed a hematoma, which is, you know, usually kind of a it's like my ankle swelled. And they're like, well, you got a hematoma in there. Well, what I had was a tumor, but they thought it was a hematoma.
Right.
And I'll never forget. I had a resident one Friday, the surgeon was gone and he's like, I'm going to drain the hematoma. And I'm like, you sure you want to do that? I mean, it was really large. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah. There's no problem. No problem at all. So he puts, you know, he numbs it, puts the needle in, draws back on the syringe. All this blood comes out. And then he detached the syringe, left the needle in and detached the syringe. And as soon as he did that, it looked like a fountain. I mean, blood just squirted all over him. Thank God he was in scrubs and not a suit or something like that. I mean, blood squirted all over him, all over the room, the floor. I mean, it didn't hurt. I wasn't in pain or anything. I was just laughing. You know, I'm like, I told you not to do this, but you know, you decided you wanted to go ahead and do it. So guess you're going to have to call housekeeping to disinfect the room here.
Jenner had a shitty day then.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen homicide scenes with a lot less blood than that, you know, it was kind of like, so
that's crazy. Yeah. a nurse I talked to a while ago, and it was just one of those, like, cops, nurses, they get in a lot of interesting situations, some of them very morbid and not good to talk on in general, the radio kind of thing. But one of them, I said, what was the craziest scene? It didn't have to be like someone took their life, but what was just like the craziest? It still bugs you, like, wow, that actually happened. And she's like, you know, she's like, there was a terrible car accident. I'm like, okay. That usually never ends well. But she's like, no, the weird part is they were fine. But the person comes in, limb is half like connected, and it's spraying like Monty Python everywhere. And I'm like, wait, what? That really can't happen? She's like, yeah, it was crazy. The whole place, the hallway was painted red. The floor was red. Like, this was red. The guy was like pretty much on like the last reserves of blood you can live on. We finally stabilized him. I'm like, that just sounded like a really stressful night. Like, it just one of those, you did medical school prepare? She's like, no, even the doctors didn't know what to do. They're like, do we cauterize in old school?
Yeah. I mean, the things you see in certainly medicine, especially emergency room medicine, and a lot of times, you know, in law enforcement are not things that you want to see, you know, they're right. You know, I always sort of laugh is, you know, the people you see naked as a cop are not the people you want to see naked as a cop. You know, I mean, it's just like, right. Ooh, that's kind of gross, but, but you just see, you see a lot of helplessness and hopelessness, and you see it night after night. And it's real important that you're grounded, because I mean, it's no secret, you know, cops have a higher suicide rate. They have a higher divorce rate. They have a higher incidence of domestic violence and things like that. And a lot of that is you need to be grounded. You know, you need to have something that you can get away from that. And I never, you know, certainly was offered, you know, hey, let's go out for a drink after shift and stuff like that. I'm like, no, I want to go home to my family. You know, that's what grounded me. That's what kept me, you know, from having to see all this stuff and realizing that the vast majority of people are not like this. You know, the vast, you know, 90% of the people are good, decent, honest, caring, loving people that just want the best for their family, their community, and their country. But right. Then you've got, you know, the 10%, the 5% on the fringes who, you know, I mean, it's kind of like business. It's the 80-20 rule. You know, 80% of your business comes from 20% of your customers. Same thing's true in law enforcement. You know, 80% of the crime comes from 20% of the people. And most of the time, if you're a good beat officer, you're going to know who that person is. Just give me a description. Oh yeah, that's Peanut, or, you know, that's whatever, you know, the guy's name is, here's where he lives. Here's where his mother lives. Here's where his baby's mama lives. You know, I can tell you all about that. And that's just being a good officer, you know, in the area you patrol. And, you know, detectives, I don't know who this person is. Can you help me? Yeah, sure. Here's the, you know, and stuff like that. So it's not something you want to see every night. It's not a job for everybody. It can definitely mess with your mind.
And that's one, at least I picked up, and I think some of the audience did too. It's like, you had to have had a grounding something to keep you focused. Cause many officers, and this applies to really anyone in the service arena, like firefighters, military, et cetera. Unless you have a goal or a reason, like a why, it's really hard to do that kind of line of work. And that's where I kind of assumed it probably was his family. He did not want to become like the others kind of thing. And once you said it, I'm like, yep. But
yeah, I mean, if you think about it, and when people ask me about, you know, what it's like, I tell them, think about this in your job. If this was your job, number one, you're going to make less money than a plumber is going to make. Number two, nobody's going to want you there. And number three, everybody's going to lie to you. So you can imagine if you go to work every day and you're making less money than a plumber, you go to the office and like, nobody wants you around. Get away from me. I don't want anything to do with you. And then everybody you talk to lies to you because they're always trying to put their best foot forward. So you'll think they're right and you'll arrest the other guy. It's like, that's your day every single day. That's every person that you interact with. And if you can live with that, that's great. But that's not a job that you're going to do unless you have some kind of an altruistic goal, you know, that you want, I want to be here. I want to make a difference. I want to help people. If you keep that in mind, then it's a lot easier to deal with that job. But you know, you can understand why cops go off and punch people and, you know, and, you know, hit them with their stick or tase them when they shouldn't or something like that.
Right.
I get it. I understand why that, I mean, you know, somebody's cussing you out and you just got to stay there and listen to it. And that's fine. But, you know, you have that night after night after night. And, you know, it was always funny because, you know, we'd be taking somebody to jail and it'd be like, you know, they're effing you this and, you know, calling you all kinds of names. And I used to just sit there and like, well, you have a good night, sir. You're going to be sleeping on concrete. I'm going to be sleeping in my bed. Have a good day.
Very true. Yeah. Where I live, the cops are, it's a smaller town, so the cops are not, well, okay, they're busy, but it's the kind that like, I'll never see it kind of thing. But I just, the chief was getting a coffee down the police station's like on the corner and the coffee shop's literally like across the way. So I saw the chief pull up and I was like, hey, my treat, like, let me buy you a coffee kind of thing. I'm like, and it was just like the, how was your night? Cause he was still going, I guess it was one of those, a couple of his officers called off. So he's like, I had to do police work. He's like, chief really shouldn't, but he's like, well, there was no one else to do it. And that's where I'm like, oh, okay. So like, what'd you do though? Like that you're up all night that you need another cup of coffee. And he's like, I did 3 different crime scenes. I'm like, okay. I think you're trying to avoid something. He's like, yes. One was the innocent woman was murdered. Her brains were everywhere. The other one, the guy's intestines were ripped out. And then he's like, the third one was just a homeless guy screaming into the wall. I'm like, I feel like the last one hurt more because of all the shit before. He's like, yep. Now I need my coffee and I gotta finish all that paperwork. I'm like, wow, that is such a lonely, painful life. And he's like, my father was a chief, so I wanted to be a chief too. I was like, okay. I'm like, good luck. Enjoy your coffee. I bought you kind of thing.
Well, that's what, you know, they always describe law enforcement as, you know, 90% boredom and 10% sheer terror, mm-hmm. You know, and that's just it. You know, you get on the scene and, you know, it's whatever it is. It's an auto accident where somebody's died or whatever, you know, and it's like, okay, yeah, horrible. But now I've got to spend 3 hours doing paperwork, you know, to make sure everything's correct, to make sure everything's right. You know, even a simple DUI for us was, my partner and I were both trained in operating the intoxilizer and we had advanced DUI training and things like that. And it was like, you know, you've got to make sure every I is dotted and every T is crossed because mm-hmm. one little slip up and the person's going to beat it in court. So you have to take your time. You have to, you know, be methodical about it. You have to do things that maybe you wouldn't normally do. You know, did you read this person his rights? Yes, I read it at this time. I read it at this time. I read it at this. So, you know, it's like, wait a minute, I read his rights 3 times. So you can't say, well, you know, you didn't read a Miranda. Yeah, I did. Read him at 3 times. And you write that down, you know, I read it at, you know, 9:48 or, you know, whatever it was. So, I mean, you know what what defense attorneys are going to ask. So you try to be a little extra diligent in that kind of an arena. And I never lost a DUI case except for one. And it wasn't that the guy was drunk or we didn't do anything. It was that he was a resident, a medical school resident, and the jury didn't want to convict him because it would have hurt his chances of, you know, advancing in medical school. And I'm like,
that's a lame excuse though.
That's what I'm like, you know what? Hey, I can only arrest him. It's up to you to convict him. If you don't want to do that, just remember he's got an alcohol problem. And you know, the next party that he goes to and he drives and he hits your daughter and kills her, that's on you. That's not on me. I did my job.
Yeah. So when it was funny, I got called for jury and actually I haven't got called back since. I think it's mainly because of that. Like they were explaining the case. They were trying to be topical. And essentially they were saying, oh, like the father reversed the ring and spanked the child. And they're like, have you been spanked this, and this at the jury? And I'm like, yeah, I've been switched. I've been spanked. I've been wooden paddle, like a reverse ring. That would actually be kind of nice compared to stuff I went through kind of thing. And literally the jury then was like, they're all like, yeah, we like all of us were pretty much tainted right out of the gate. And then the judge said something, the lawyer said something, and I'm like, oh, you both just contradicted yourself. I'm like, so then I would consider him innocent because you both don't have your data straight. And literally the judge called a 5-minute break. I came back and they said, all of you go. And I've never gotten called for jury duty again. I'm like, whoo.
Yeah, you don't want smart people on a jury. I mean, you want people that'll, you know, I always used to say, if you did the crime, you want a jury trial. If you're innocent, you want a bench trial. You want to try it in front of a judge because the judge has heard this stuff a million times. You know, I want a bench trial. But if you did it, you want a jury trial because all you got to do is convince one of them that you're innocent.
Mm-hmm. And that's just, And then it gets into the whole debate of the system. But So well, for your motivational speakers, like speaking, what was on top of you, like your cancer and all that? Would you go into like mindset tactics too and or whatever else? Like, what would they be?
Yeah, I do. I talk a lot about, you know, how you can stay positive through all this. And I talk about what I call my four truths. And these are things that I've kind of come to realize over this past 9 years. I mean, some of them started earlier, but, and I'll give them to you. I have them on a post-it note right here on my desk, and they're just one sentence each. And I use them to kind of make decisions. Do I want to do this treatment? Do I want to get involved in this project? Whatever it is. So the first one is you need to control your mind or it will control you. The second one is you need to embrace the pain and the difficulty that we all experience in life and use it to make you a stronger and more determined individual. The third one is more of a legacy truth. And it's this: what you leave behind is what you weave in the hearts of other people. And then the fourth one is pretty self-explanatory. As long as you don't quit, you can never be defeated. You know, and I talk about we're all going to experience pain in life. And it doesn't have to be pain like mine, like cancer. You know, it could be you flunk an exam at school, or you break up with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, or you don't get the promotion at work that you think you deserve. Pain is inevitable. It is. Suffering, on the other hand, that's optional. That's what you do with that pain. Do you use that pain to make you stronger, to make you tougher, to make you more determined? Or do you wallow in it and, you know, feel bad for yourself and sorry for yourself and want others to feel sorry for you? I mean, I don't want your audience to think that, you know, there's an S on my chest and I have a cape. I don't. I have bad days. You know, I'm a human being. I get down. I get depressed. I cry. But I just don't let myself stay there. You know, I use that ugliness and I use it to make me stronger. I burn it as fuel or use it as energy to make me tougher and to make me stronger. So a lot of what I talk about kind of rolls along those lines.
The legacy one that got me, that was the whatever you reap now, others in the future will benefit from it. That was like, wow. Yeah, it's like this one motivational speaker I was listening to on like YouTube, and he was saying, what you do now, you will never see it in your lifetime, but you could help 800 million people in five generations. You could literally change the world from your choices today. And now that I just sat there and I'm like, wow, the game's bigger than we can ever figure out, kind of thing.
Yeah. And that's something that I learned, you know, being involved in team sports my whole life, you know, pretty much up through college. You know, when you're involved in team sports, you realize that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but you let your teammates down, your coaches down, you know, your fans down, your parents down, et cetera. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is the game of life. And, you know, especially young people get criticized a lot for, you know, it's all about me. You know, I don't care about anything else. It's all about me. It's not all about you. It's about us. And us together can do just about anything. You individually can't do a damn thing.
What was it like? You can go by yourself fast, but not far. But if you go together, it's like slow, but like infinite kind of thing. I think I really butchered that, but.
No. I mean, it's kind of like when we were at the, you know, we were at the range, it was, you know, slow is smooth, smooth is fast, you know, and that's what we always were beat into our head with, you know, withdrawing, you know, slow, don't, you know, I got to get the gun out. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast, you know, and that was something that, I mean, it applies to a whole lot more than just firearms training when I was a policeman.
Oh yeah. Like I do martial arts training. Like you can't see it's over there, my outfit, but that was the biggest one going through the ranks for me. My martial arts instructor is super like pro gun. So it's super funny at times. He'll actually bring like a really good BB gun with like the yellow cap and all that, but we'd actually do the training, but he specifically I noticed this at a young rank. I was like, he had us do it like 60 times really slow, like almost painful slow. You're like, why are we just going like this kind of thing? And as now a higher rank in the system, I'm like, oh, like if I didn't do that, I literally, my body would not know what to do. It would just be like, oh, I just flick, done. But if I did it slow, all the muscles learn and remember. So now what I do, because he's gotten to the point, he's like, all right, we got a lot of shit to go through, like faster, faster. And I'm like, nope, we're going slow. I'm going to reverse this on you now.
And well, and that's something, you know, that we were taught, you know, in a critical incident, you know, all the things that happen to your body. And that's why, you know, we draw on fire, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of times, because in a critical incident, your fine motor skills go right out the window. And like you say, it's all muscle memory. You know, you remembered all those thousand times that you drew. You know, you get tunnel vision. You don't hear things. You know, everything slows down. All these things happen to you in a critical incident. And, you know, people talk about, you know, police shootings and stuff like that. If you think about it, the average police shooting takes place in a span of somewhere between 5 and 10 feet and lasts 2.5 seconds, and it's over. You know, so, I mean, if you think about it, it's not like the old West where, you know, you're chasing somebody around on a horse and you're shooting at, you know, like that doesn't happen. You know, it's like, boom, it's over. So that's why you need muscle memory. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast.
100%. Yeah, it may not be a popular opinion, but I agree with that. It's like you get it to where it's rooted in you. And even if, like, I joke with my buddies, because I used to be a heavy alcoholic, but now I'm not. So that they realized at a certain point when I was drunk, I could still do all the martial arts, a little sloppy. But they're like, dude, this is deep in you. I'm like, yeah, like it's not going anywhere.
No,
I could get my brain knocked out. My body, my hand's still going to just be moving around. I don't know why. Kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And that's what the one thing I always would joke with him. If I could do it drunk, I pretty much have mastered it, kind of thing.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And I'm like, but yeah, that is, I know my one martial arts buddy, actually, I haven't seen him in a while, but he's training to be a cop, and he has the whole gear, like everything he bought, he does security. And it was one of those, at one point we got really mad at him. He would bring his gun and just unsheath, aim on like for hours in the dojo, because he couldn't do it at his home. And that's where my instructor was like, yeah, just make sure it's an empty barrel. This is where we all got mad at him. He unsheathed his gun and pointed the barrel at me and said, it's empty. You're ready to get, just got where this went wrong, right? I cock it back and I notice there's still the magazine and a bullet in the barrel. I literally pistol whipped him like, you motherfucker, kind of thing. So yeah,
never point a gun at something you're not willing to destroy.
It was like this too. I was throwing like, you motherfucker, just beat the shit out of him. It was essentially, that's what we did all day. It's like, you're not bringing that back now.
Yeah.
You lost all rights.
That's just a safety. You know, I mean, yeah, that's scary.
It was. And I used to work at an ammo plant, and I got that instilled in me real quick, because like we had to test the product. It was a private company. So we would make a batch and then we take a little bit of it random, like, so it would be good. And we'd all go test it. Well, before going to that ammo company, I've never shot a gun. I don't know all the rules. And they knew that hiring me. So it was one of those, I didn't know, and I accidentally swiped someone. And they pretty much said, if you do that again, they're like, there's always explosions going off here. They're not going to know the difference. And we have a farm in the back with pigs. Immediately, I was just like, okay, teach me everything. So, yep. But yeah, that was one of those. I told the kid, I'm like, dude, I don't even own my own gun and I know how to properly handle it. And you're doing this for a job. Like, you really need to get your shit straight.
Yep.
Yep. Kind of thing.
Yep. You can end up in prison just because you made a stupid mistake.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we were telling him, is like, either you're going to wind up dead, or you're going to wish you were dead, because you're going to be in a place that you just, it's not good.
Right.
And yeah. But other than that, kid's doing good. I think he has a potential like wife, girlfriend thing. He's just trying to get through the college. Did you have to do college, by the way, to get into police officer back then?
No.
Really?
No. No, but I always thought that the more education you have, the better off you are dealing with people.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have to get a master's degree, but it was something I wanted to do because I thought it would make me just a better person.
That's actually very smart and wise. Yeah. He was telling me now, like, you need a minimum of bachelor's in something. And I'm like, to be a cop, to make roughly 50K a year, like, they're not even going to bump your pay for having a BS or whatever. And he's like, nope. I'm like, I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, I mean, it's like anything else. It's like the economy. You know, when the economy is good and jobs are plentiful, you're not going to get really good cops. But, you know, when the economy is bad and there aren't a lot of jobs out there and you have a degree and you want to be a policeman, okay, you'll have a much greater pool to pick from. So, you know, it's not a job for everybody. I used to talk to the kids at the academy and I'd be like, you know what? They're going to spend 6 months teaching you how to use all these little tools on your belt. But the two greatest tools that you bring to this job are this and this. Mm-hmm. What you say and how you say it can turn a yes person into a no person or a no person into a yes person. You know, not every time, but, right. You know, if you're here because you think you want to kick ass and take names, you're going to run into somebody pretty quickly who's bigger, stronger, and faster than you. And not only are you going to get yourself hurt, you might get your partner hurt as well.
Yeah, it's like, if it's not for you, just make sure your partner doesn't get taken out, kind of thing.
Right.
If you want to be an idiot and go kill yourself, go for it, kind of thing.
Yeah. 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 But that's the problem. You end up living and, you know, it's some, you know, your innocent partner, or, you know, another officer just showed up on the scene who ends up taking a bullet.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the sad stories I've heard. And it seems okay. Like the guy commented earlier, like the criminals mostly in a system. And I told him, like, but why would that be? And he's like, well, he said, there are still cops like me who care about our job. And like, we work very hard, but he's like, because we actually do our job, no one notices it. And I just sat there and I always stuck. I'm like, huh, but wouldn't you want people to know you're doing your job, kind of thing? And he's like, those are the others. They want the attention. So they'll do anything to get attention. He's like, and that means anything. And I'm like, oh, again, I was younger. I'm like, I kind of get what you're going for. Maybe not really, but okay. Kind of thing. And that's when I now, like at my age, looking back, I'm like, wow, he wasn't kidding. Like literally they'll do anything, kind of thing.
Yeah. And those are people without integrity. I mean, that's the biggest, you know, if you wanted to say what's the most important word in law enforcement, it would be integrity. Because really? once you lie, once you plant evidence, once you do something, you know, there are mistakes of the head and there are the mistakes of the heart. You know, you made an error. Okay. People can forgive error.
Right.
You made an error and you knew it was wrong. That's kind of hard to take, you know, and especially if you've got to go to court, you know, if you lie, if you get caught in a lie, your credibility for the rest of your police career is shot. You're never going to be able to testify without having another attorney say, you know, hey, Josh, in 19, whatever, didn't you say this? And wasn't that a lie? Well, why should the jury believe anything you're saying now? You know, it's integrity is incredibly important. And, you know, you don't get a lot of credit for the work that you do. And you've got to be okay with that. You've got to be okay that, you know what, I made a difference tonight. Nobody's going to know about it. Nobody's going to see it. Nobody's going to read it in the newspaper or see it on the news. But you know what? I made a difference tonight. I'm good with that. I go home and, you know, sleep well tonight.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of correlation between like the police and military service and entrepreneurship. And that's where I've recently been very fascinated with it. Cause I'm like, there's a lot of correlation and not many people realize it either.
No, there's not. And that's, you know, I'm reading James Mattis's book, you know, Mad Dog Mattis, who was Trump's defense secretary and was a 4-star in the Marine Corps and stuff like that. Great book about leadership, you know, about taking care of your people, about, you know, here's what's expected of you. And again, you knew this was wrong or you should have known it was wrong. I'm sorry, I've got to relieve you of your duties and put somebody else in there and stuff like that. It's an excellent, I think, book about leadership.
I'll definitely look that up then.
Yeah, it's called Call Sign Chaos is the name of the book.
call sign chaos. Yeah, the one thing with like you were saying earlier with the lawyer interrogating, like investigating, like, oh, you lied here kind of thing. I took a class in like high school. It was a former like detective from our local PD, and he was just doing this for fun to pass the time, make a little extra money. And it was one of those, he brought, it was a forensic class, and he brought an old case when he was on the service, 30 years old, never solved it kind of thing. Couldn't figure it out. So he handed us the printed out and all this, and we're reading it. He's like, read it all tonight. That's your homework. And then he's like, we have the actual, the chief at the time, but detective turned private PI, coming in tomorrow. So I read it. I was like super fascinated. I'm like, how did this guy get away with it? And then it was one of those, as I'm reading it, this is where the integrity part kicks in. The brother lied in three different places. Super small. If you weren't looking for that, you'd never see it. And it was one of those, I told him, like, yeah, the brother lied, like here, here, and here. And the chief looks at it and he's like, literally runs out the building, calls his buddy, who's the detective at the time, says, arrest the brother. A kid in high school just figured it out. And it was just one of those, I just was like, but I like putting puzzles together. It's like, yeah, can I, kind of thing.
Yeah, you probably make a great, you know, cold case, you know, investigator and stuff like that. Yeah, sometimes, you know, on cases, you know, homicide cases and stuff like that, there's just so many moving parts, mm-hmm. that you just, you know, like you said, you caught it because you read it. The chief probably had read it, you know, 15 times, and it was just
just went blind, you know, to it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, totally blocked on it.
Yeah, and that's where I was just sat there, and they never told us the reason for the murder. So I asked the chief, I'm like, what was the reason? He's like, once he finally got the guy, he bought me a burrito and everything the next day. Nice. And I was like, yeah, I got food. And I was like walking around the room like, I saw the case. But I asked him later, I'm like, what was the reason? When he said, you know, it was over $100 and he took his brother's life. And I'm like, that's so stupid. I'm like, $100? Like, you can literally find that if you look hard enough on the street kind of thing. I'm like, it sounds shitty, but like, if at least if it was a million, like, kind of, but not, life's not worth it. But I'm like, I kind of see where you were going for that, but I'm like,
$100. You'd be surprised what people kill each other over.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, it could be as simple as, you know, you like the Cowboys and I like the Texans or something like that, or, you know,
yeah.
And it's like, I'm going to shoot. What? You shot your brother over the fact that he likes a team that you, I mean, life is way too trivial these days, you know, when you look at the homicides and why people kill other people. It's ridiculous.
It really is. And it was just one of those, I'm like, wow, $100. And you've had 30, 40 years with your brother, and you just that one thing broke it. Kind of thing. And that's where I've just sat there and I'm like you said, smallest thing, and people just die. And it's like, I just don't get, is it just one of those, the mind cracks? Is, I don't think psychology could fully at least explain it in the moment.
Yeah, kind of not usually. And a lot of times alcohol or drugs are involved on top of it.
Yeah.
You know, and when that happens, you know, you get a lot of liquid courage and stuff like that. And, you know, which makes it even more stupid. You know, I've always said it, if we didn't have alcohol, drugs, or mental illness, we wouldn't need nearly as many cops as we need in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Also, just respectable guys like you, like the local PD. I was just being a high schooler. I was making noise like after 10 p.m., noise ordinance and all that. And I also was just smart enough to know, like, I told him, like, hey, like, I mean no harm, but I have at least two pocket knives on me. I'll pull them out. Just, like, let me move and don't shoot kind of thing. So, but that's where, like, I pulled him out. And the funny thing, my buddy had this cool, like, circle blade. And it wasn't illegal. It looked really cool. And the cop's flipping it. And that's where they just let us go. And he's still flipping the knife. And he, like, reaches, like, can I have it back? I'm like, if he wants the knife, just let him have it kind of thing. We go buy you a new one later.
Yeah.
This could have been a really bad incident if they caught us with all this. And that's where the cop's like, here you go.
Yeah. Like, I'd like to keep it, but I really can't. Yeah.
Right. It was Joe and told him, like, dude, at this point, if he wants a knife, great. If he wants $10, great. kind of think, well, this could have been really bad for us.
Yeah, I remember when I was a little kid, we were out playing basketball at like 10:30 at night on my friend's driveway. You know, the local Oaklawn Police Department cop rolls up. He didn't even get out of the car. He's like, hey, guys, you know, I'm glad you're doing something constructive, you know, and not, you know, something that's would get you in trouble. But the neighbors are complaining. It's getting late. Could you go inside? And my friend walks up to the car and like sticks his head, you know, puts his hand on the door frame and sticks his head in. I'm like, Jim, get the. I mean, I'm surprised the guy didn't knock him, you know, three blocks away. Like, get the heck away from my car, idiot. You know, but the cop was real cool. It's like, you know, back up, just go inside, you know, and right. I'm going to drive away. And I just don't want another call kind of thing. I mean, it's stuff like that. I remember thinking, you know, you want to lock everybody up. We don't want to lock everybody up. We don't want to take people to jail. We'd much rather be able to just get voluntary compliance, have you stay in your house or wherever you are. It, you know, it's too much paperwork having to, you know, lock somebody up and all that. It's like, okay. You know, we just like to, I mean, we're people. Let's talk. Can we work this out? Okay. You go inside. We're done. Have a nice day.
It's like, the thing I say, but I'm starting to realize it's a very common saying amongst people or thinking is like, we're human, shit happens. If you make a mistake, like you were saying earlier, honest mistake, easily, it's easy to ignore it kind of thing. Like, we won't hold that over your head. If you maliciously made a mistake, then it's like the,
yeah, you knew it was wrong and you did it anyway. Yeah, we got a problem.
Right. And that's the thing I always have to tell myself is like, we're human. Like, we're not perfect. If we are perfect, then what's the point of existence, at least on this plane of existence kind of thing.
I mean, and that's the part of law enforcement, you know, that's really kind of up for debate now. You know, it's like, you know, there are cases where we're not held to the same standard. You know, I mean, you're asking me to make a split second life and death decision, you know, when it's cold out, when it's snowing, when I've had 3 hours of sleep. Well, you've got to cut me a break because I may make a mistake in that case. You know, not a malicious mistake, but here's what I thought, or here's what I saw. So this is how I reacted. But, you know, now it's like, no, you know, there's no immunity. You know, we can take your house. We can take your pension. We can take your kids' college fund. I mean, you're going to start doing that and people are going to be like, I'm being a cop. You know, I'm just not going to do it. And you're looking at the number of people that are retiring. You're looking at, I mean, here in Denver, I want to say the Denver Sheriff's Department's down 120 deputies.
Yeah. It's like, did Denver defund like a lot of other places?
Yeah, Denver didn't defund, but the state of Colorado took away immunity. Said, you know, you're not immune anymore. People can sue you and take your house. And so cops are like,
all right, I'm changing jobs then.
Yeah, I'll just, you know, something happens, call us. I'll come. I'll take the report. Have a nice day. Nope.
Right.
I'm not chasing the guy. I'm not making traffic stops. I'm not. You know, I'm not doing anything like that, you know, and I can't tell you the amount of, you know, guns, dope, wanted people, you know, people with no driver's license or insurance that I would get out of. You don't have one of your headlights is out.
Right.
You know, a simple traffic stop like that. And you get, you know, all kinds of stuff out of it. And now cops are like, oh, we don't care. We're not, you got a headlight out. You got a headlight out. I don't care. I'm not stopping you for it.
Right.
And the bad guys know it. So
it really is that, like when I was up in Washington a couple of weeks ago, this old guy, his name's Don, we were in his house. He watches the news like religiously and it's super funny. Old vet from Korea. And like, as we're eating our like makeshift tacos in Washington, cause they don't have like fresh taco stuff. It comes on the news that like, crime is rampant in Seattle. And it was just one of those, I'm like, I looked at Don and then everyone else at the table, like, oh, why is the crime going up? I'm like, did you guys not remember earlier when there was a complete takeover of the station? And then the governor was like, this is too mean. We're going to defund them completely. So I'm like, they're understaffed, underfunded, and you expect them to function the same. I'm like,
And underappreciated.
Well, they're greatly underappreciated. And it was just one of those, I'm like, okay, I'm not saying like certain movements are important or not, but like just logistically speaking, how do you expect things to get done? And that's where they all looked at me like, oh yeah, well, when you put it like that, I'm like, just saying like the Denver thing, if I know I'm going to get sued for pulling someone over, just tapping them on the shoulder, I'm not going to do shit.
Exactly. I mean, I make the same amount of money whether I answer the radio or whether I do proactive policing. So, I mean, you want to help, you want to make a difference. You don't like policing like that. But at a point in time, if you're not going to be supported by the community, it's not worth, you know, somebody being able to sue me over my house or my kid's college fund or my pension. It's like, sorry, you know, yeah, your house got broken into. I'll show up, take a report, turn it over to an investigator. Oh, wait a minute. All the investigators are now in uniform because we don't have enough cops on the street. So, yeah, your case probably isn't going to get solved. Sorry.
Yeah. And it was just one of those. I just sat there. I'm like, guys, like, we all say we're underpaid in America. Yeah, we sort of, depending on where you are. But I'm like, these guys knowingly understand they're being underpaid. They're getting attacked left and right by the politics and the community because they're like, you're overpaid. We're underpaying you now. I'm like, they barely make 50K a year. Like barely, depending on the station, maybe like 68, if you're lucky. Or you've been there for like 30 years. And I'm like, this, even me that's making like 30K a year, I wouldn't take that job on. I'm like, that's truly a calling kind of thing. And these people know it. And I'm like, these people know it too. But now you're attacking them for their calling. So why should they stand behind their flag now? And that's where I sit there and I'm like, are you only thinking on emotional plane? Because like, you got to get some logic involved here.
True.
Well, it's been almost an hour and a half.
Yeah, it has. I actually have an eye appointment I have to go to.
Oh, that's what I was like. I noticed your eyes. I'm like, okay, we better. Where can everyone contact you, Terry?
So the easiest way to get a hold of me is through my website, which is called Motivational Check. So motivationalcheck.com will get you to me. You can leave me a message. You can get my social media sites through there. You can get access to my book and all that stuff through motivationalcheck.com.
Wonderful. Thank you, Terry, so much.
Thank you, Josh. It was fun talking to you.
An absolute pleasure.
You take care of yourself.
I will. Well, congratulations. You made it to the end. You're an awesome person. Not many make it here. So, being the awesome person that you are, can you do me one more awesome favor? Can you rate and review this on whatever podcast services you're using? App, if you do it on Apple and you leave an actual written review, I have a thing on my website. I will take your written review and post it for all to see. Congratulations, you're permanently sealed on my site. Otherwise, I am trying to do YouTube more and live streaming. I will try to put as many of the YouTube links in the description of the show as I can. So give your boy some extra help over on YouTube. Watch my videos. I just mute it and change the channel, change the window or something. But yeah, that's it. Thank you for being awesome and see you next time.